The MIT ozone study is one of those scientific findings that quietly rewrites a chapter of environmental history. Researchers used atmospheric records and model reconstructions to determine that measurable ozone depletion actually began in 1957, not 1985, when the Antarctic ozone hole was first formally documented, and which has been treated as the start date for most ozone-related policy and scientific analysis. The difference of 28 years matters enormously for understanding how long anthropogenic chemicals had been affecting stratospheric ozone before anyone noticed, and it has implications for how we model recovery timelines and verify the effectiveness of the Montreal Protocol.
The larger context is the European heat wave that has already killed more than 1,300 people as measured by excess mortality since June 21st. Swiss glaciers hitting their second earliest glacier loss day on record, meaning the point in the calendar year when net glacier mass loss begins exceeding a certain threshold, is another concrete data point in a year that is tracking as one of the warmest in recorded history. Back in the United States, the heat dome is pushing dangerous temperatures to over 100 million Americans right as we head into the July 4th weekend.
The Lyell Hill Fire, burning 1,500 acres in the Columbia River Gorge and forcing evacuations, is a reminder that the western United States fire season is already active in late June. The Columbia River Gorge is ecologically sensitive. It's one of the most biodiverse regions in the Pacific Northwest, and fires there have implications beyond property destruction.
On the innovation front, BridgeBio's Phase 3 achondroplasia results published in the New England Journal of Medicine are genuinely exciting from a medical perspective. Achondroplasia is the most common form of dwarfism, affecting roughly 1 in 25,000 births globally. The condition is caused by a specific mutation in the FGFR3 gene. BridgeBio's oral drug, infigratinib, showed the largest height gains ever recorded in a phase 3 trial for this condition, and the company is planning FDA submission this quarter. An oral treatment option for a condition that previously had limited pharmaceutical interventions is a meaningful advancement.
The FDA also accepted Sandoz's applications for generic versions of Mounjaro and Zepbound, Eli Lilly's tirzepatide-based obesity and diabetes drugs. This is a significant milestone in the GLP-1 drug access story. Generic entry won't happen immediately. The FDA process will take time, and Lilly will likely pursue patent litigation. But the acceptance of Sandoz's applications starts the formal clock on what could eventually be a much more accessible and affordable version of the most commercially successful drug class of this decade.
The NASA spacewalk today at the International Space Station, astronauts heading out to repair the robotic arm, is a reminder that even as commercial space dominates the headlines, the ISS remains operational and dependent on regular maintenance. The robotic arm, known as Canadarm2, is critical for berthing cargo vehicles and supporting extravehicular activities, so restoring its full function has operational significance for the remaining planned life of the station.
Morgan Stanley's designation of sodium as the new oil, in the context of rising sodium ion battery technology, deserves more serious analysis than the catchy headline suggests. Sodium ion batteries are a genuine technological alternative to lithium ion for stationary storage applications. Sodium is abundant and cheap. Salt really is everywhere. And while sodium ion batteries have lower energy density than lithium ion for grid storage, where weight and size matter less than cost and cycle life, they're increasingly competitive. Morgan Stanley's framing suggests they see a commodity supercycle potential in sodium sources for battery production.
And Austin's use of Waymo robo-taxi data to identify potholes is a small story with large implications. The city has found about 4 dozen potholes since spring using the sensor data from Waymo vehicles, data that the vehicles were collecting anyway for navigation purposes. The efficiency question here is whether municipalities can systematically harvest infrastructure monitoring data from autonomous vehicles without creating new privacy or liability frameworks. If it works at scale, it fundamentally changes how cities do road maintenance prioritization.
Which brings us to the Waymo Uber Phoenix partnership ending. They had a commercial agreement to deploy Waymo vehicles through the Uber app in Phoenix. The dissolution suggests that either the unit economics didn't work for one or both parties, or that Waymo is confident enough in its own direct-to-consumer service that it doesn't need Uber's distribution. Meanwhile, Tesla's Cybercab beginning road tests in Austin puts two major autonomous vehicle platforms operating in the same city simultaneously, which will generate useful comparative data about how different systems handle the same road conditions.